Nama Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Could someone take this, please? Okay. So yesterday we read through text 62, which was explaining about the first seven of the 10 topics as given by Srila Suta Goswami, and explaining them and also drawing out comparisons with the 10 topics as given by Shukadev. So we went through seven of them. There's three to go, and then a conclusion. So let's see now, 63.1. Jiva Goswami quotes the next verse in the seventh chapter of the 12th canto. This is about annihilation, devastation. There are four types of cosmic annihilations: occasional, elemental, continuous, and ultimate, all of which are effected by the inherent potency of the Supreme Lord. Learned scholars have designated this topic dissolution, samsara. In this verse, the word asya, his, refers to the Parameshwar, the Supreme Lord, while swabhavata, due to nature, means by his energy. The term atyantika, ultimate, implies that mukti, liberation, is included in this kind of dissolution. So now there isn't a, clear description of these four types of annihilations here, but in his purport, Jiva Goswami does give that. So, the first one, the Sanskrit is naimittik, which means occasional. That refers to the devastation at the end of each day of Brahma. The end of each day of Brahma, there's a dissolution. So, that is called naimittik, occasional. Then, the next one is prakritik. Prakritik, which it says here, elemental. You can also say complete. This is at the end of the life of Lord Brahma. We all know, I think, at the end of the life of Lord Brahma, the entire material creation is wound up, not just up to certain planetary systems and the rest remains, not like that, not even within the universe, and then Lord Brahma puts it together again within the universe after a little while. But it means all the universes, everything is wound up. And everything, the whole creation, returns back to that state of pradhan, that unmanifest state of matter, which, we gave the example of the soup, the cosmic soup, any type of soup. If you put some vegetables in and some spices and so on, you boil it for long enough, and eventually you'll get something which is just, you cannot recognize what it is. Was it cauliflower? Was it, what was it actually? Everything just merges together. So pradhan means matter in that type of state. Actually, it's composed of many ingredients. At the beginning there, when Jiva Goswami was presenting Shukadev Goswami's description of Saruga from the second canto, the initial primary creation, then he mentioned the five gross elements, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, then the five senses, sensory functions, smelling, seeing, tasting, touching, hearing, and various others. So these are all specific ingredients. And when when matter, the material world, is in the state of mahatattva, then all these particular ingredients are manifest in and of themselves, distinct from the others, and can be identified, so to speak. There's earth, there's water, there's fire, like this. This is the idea, at least. But when matter is in the state of pradhan, then all those things are broken down and just mixed up together. So that's what happens. That's what happens in the prakritic, or it's called here elemental creation, or amina, devastation, or complete devastation, which happens at the end of the life of Lord Brahma. Everything's wound up, everything, and the whole material creation reverts back to just being pradhan, just a cloud of matter. And then after a while, Mahavishnu glances at it again. So, we mentioned right at the beginning, if you recall, how the creation begins with the glance of Mahavishnu, which consists of various items, or which contains various items. And the crucial item, at least the initial item which really begins this whole process of going from pradhan and then developing eventually to this point, that the crucial element, active principle, initial one, was time. So when time is withdrawn, then everything starts reverting back until it comes to that condition of pradhan, and everything is then withdrawn back into Mahavishnu, including you and me. Hopefully we won't be around still. Let's pray to Krishna. But anyway, whoever, the conditioned souls who are still around at the end of Lord Brahma's life, then they are also going to be drawn back into the body of Mahavishnu. So, like that. So that is the second type of creation, the prakritic, which is referred to here or translated here as elemental, but you could say complete. Now the next two types of annihilations, devastations, they're quite interesting. The third one is called nitya. Nitya means, well, generally we take it to mean eternal. But there can also be a slightly different sense, which isn't really different, ultimately. But I think in terms of like the impression that we may have of it within our minds, we'll kind of feel or relate to it as being somewhat different. That is constant. If something is always going on in a certain way, it can be called nitya. So what is this nitya then? Annihilation, which is always going on. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's just always going on.
Body.
The body, that's correct. Even not just the body, but all material things are in a process of deterioration, isn't it? Everything material. on a moment-by-moment basis is heading step-by-step towards destruction. So, the inexorable moment-by-moment progression of everything in the material world toward annihilation is called the nitya, or continuous dissolution. Srila Prabhupada would laugh sometimes about how people, ordinary people, celebrate birthdays. They're looking forward to their next birthday. You know, particularly children, maybe particularly everyone, perhaps, but this is definitely there. Oh, my next birthday is coming. Today is my birthday. Very good. I'm 50-something years old. Prabhupada said that actually, really speaking, it is just like an official notification that you are 1 year closer to death now. And even in your early days, like the human body at least generally comes to its peak in the mid-20s or thereabouts, and then sort of starts tapering off. At least my recollection, which is a little hazy even now, when I got to be about 30, I think I felt some type of deterioration. And I know when I got to 40, wow, and 50, well, we won't even talk about it, but even those early birthdays, you know, when you're 5 years old, your future looks bright to you. You know, you're going places, you're getting bigger, you're getting stronger, your intelligence is developing, you're becoming more capable. So you feel, yes, you know, I'm progressing. But it's still the same thing. It's just the same thing, really. It's just got a superficial appearance of improvement. But actually, it's just the same thing. In different clothes. Something like that. So that's this nitya type of dissolution. Then the atyantic one. That's a very interesting one. Ultimate. The ultimate one. Jiva Goswami, in his explanation, he mentions, actually this ultimate annihilation is the ultimate, final, conclusive one. And after it, there is not another one. Which one is that? That's liberation. Mukti. Particularly in the sense of Krishna consciousness, which is how Shukadev presented it, wasn't it? Do you remember what was that verse that was quoted, that actually Shukadev spoke, or that one line from the verse about mukti, which makes it clear that actually it means going back to Godhead, not just impersonal liberation? Right, very good. Muktir hitvanyata rupam swarupena vyavastati. That mukti, liberation, what it really is, it's swarup. The real form of liberation as opposed to other things, particularly impersonal liberation, which we might think are like real liberations. But actual real liberation, muktir hitvanyata rupam, its real form is when you are situated in your swarup. Jivera swarup hoya, Krishnera nityadas, means when you go back to Godhead, when you come to the platform of pure love of God and you're again situated in your eternal relationship with Krishna. Face to face. That really is what mukti is. So when you get that mukti, then it is called atyantik. It's ultimate. There is not another one beyond it, for you at least. You won't be going through, you know, any other type of annihilation. That's the end. You go back to Godhead for eternal life, full of bliss and full of knowledge. So these are these four types of devastations. So what do we notice then? Well, we notice that in terms of Shukadev, if we compare Shukadev's 10 to Suta Goswami's 10, we find that this one of Suta's, it is equivalent, well, you tell me, what is it equivalent to in Shukadev's? Yes? Niroda, yes? And Mukti, correct. So, dissolution, annihilation, devastation, samsara. As explained by Sutta, equals Niroda, devastation from Shukadev Goswami, plus Mukti, plus liberation. And just as a point of interest, in his commentary on this verse, Jiva Goswami says that there's also another type of annihilation. Well, type in the historical sense, but it's within one of these types. He says there is a partial universal devastation at the end of the life of every Manu. And the everything up to the level of the earth, at least, is submerged. But he says this is of the Nimittic type. In other words, Nimittic is a type. It's not just at the end of every day of Brahma. Then you get a Nimittic devastation, an occasional devastation. But it's also at the end of every, the life of every Manu. So just imagine, you know, Lord Brahma. There are 14 Manus in one day of Brahma. And there are 14 devastations, at least up to the level of the earth planet, every day of Brahma. Can you imagine being Brahma? It means every hour of your day. Every hour you've got to go and deal with this, you know, the lower planets, earth, all these things being wiped out. Bit of a challenge, isn't it? Can you imagine? Well, some will go up. Those who can manage it will go up to higher planets. Others will just, you know, die. Yeah, and then be born again. Yes. Yeah, basically, yeah. Okay, so that's 63.1. 63.2. Out of so this is then the next Bhagavatam verse 12.7.18 from Suta Goswami. Out of ignorance, the living being performs material activities and thereby becomes, in one sense, the cause of the creation, maintenance, and destruction of the universe. Some authorities call the living being the personality underlying the material creation, while others say he is the unmanifest self. So Jiva Goswami says, the hetu, the cause here, is the nimitta, or efficient cause. Asya, of this, refers to this universe, the existence of which is due to the jivas who act in ignorance. Some call that same cause the anushayi, the underlying personality. highlighting the principle of consciousness, while others call him avyakrita, unmanifest, focusing attention on the jiva's upadis. These are all words from the verse. Yeah, so the bottom line really is that, well, sometimes Prabhupada would raise the question, where did the prison come from? Who made the prison? So, you know, of course, people will say, well, the government made the prison, of course. But if you look at it from a slightly different point of view, this point of view, then you would have to say that the criminals made the prison, really. They're the ones who made the prison. Because if there weren't any of them, there wouldn't be one. So in that sense, it's the jiva, the conditioned soul, who is the hetu, the cause of the material world. So here, this is essentially an equivalent of uti in Shukadev Goswami's list. Uti. Uti is what? The desire, the material desires of the conditioned souls. So this is what it is. Because of the conditioned souls' desires, the material world is here. So it's just another type of perspective on uti. I mean, in a sense, you could say it's also connected with sarga and visarga. Because if there were no conditioned souls to be glanced into the material world, I don't think Mahavishnu would bother glancing. Because, you know, Mahavishnu, he is not sleeping. There's an interesting story, I don't know if you ever heard, that when down in Sri Rangam, if you've heard of Sri Rangam, biggest temple in India, so just recently, or maybe in the last 10 years or something, several years even, they finally built the last Gopuram, the last entrance tower over the main entrance. Finally, after several hundred years, they finally did it. And they had a big opening ceremony, and all sorts of dignitaries came, and somehow one of the Shankaracharyas, there are four Shankaracharyas. They're the leaders of Shankaracharya's line. There are four of them. It's like an ongoing thing. Shankaracharya of Kanchi, of Dwaraka, and somewhere other places. Puri, and somewhere. Where is it? I see, okay. So anyway, the Shankaracharya of Kanchi came. Actually, he donated money to help finish that thing. So I don't know what sort of impersonalist he is, but he is an impersonalist. So he came because he donated some money. He came and attended the program. And in his impersonal way, he said, yes, here at Sri Rangam, there is Ranganath, who is Vishnu, in that state of slumber. And the Shankaracharya said, he is sleeping. He is in Tamagun. So, you know, down there in Sri Rangam, they got, you know, obviously things are a little mixed up with Kali Yuga being there, but they got a few fired up people down there, Sri Vaishnavs. So one of them sued him and took him to court for saying that. Like, you know, what would you say? Slander or something. Yeah. So, Mahavishnu, we were saying, that if there weren't any jivas to inject into the material world in his glance, he wouldn't bother glancing because in that state of yoga nidra, you know, it's a mystical trance, a transcendental trance. He is absorbed internally in his eternal relationship with Rama, his consort. as Radha is to Krishna, Rama is to Mahavishnu. Radha happens to be outside of Krishna, of course. Rama Devi is not, usually. She stays within, because she is the internal, or the pleasure potency at least. So because the relationship is so deep and so powerful, his consciousness is just fully absorbed in that. So therefore externally it looks like, well, some might think it looks like he's asleep. He's not really asleep. It's just that his consciousness is absorbed internally with Rama Devi. But then, every now and then, he glances. And all this whole business goes on. Creation and everything. So, in other words, when he glances, of course, as we mentioned the other day, the ultimate factor in terms of his idea, what he feels he's doing, why he's doing it, the ultimate idea is, I want to give these fallen conditioned souls another chance to become corrected. That's his mercy. Therefore it all happens. But at the same time, his attention becomes somewhat given to the material creation and is somewhat not so focused on Rama Devi. So then, at the end of the creation, he closes his eyes again. And his attention goes back, wholly and solely, to Rama Devi. And that's what he likes, you know. Even though he's very compassionate, it's not like he's really keen to have a material creation going on. Other than in the sense of giving the conditioned souls a chance. But of course he knows, most of them aren't going to take the chance and they're just, you know, going to try and have some sort of festival of sense gratification. So it's not that he's particularly thrilled with the material creation. Actually, the relationship with Rama Devi is much nicer. But still, out of his kindness, he gives his attention to the material creation and oversees it all. But then it's withdrawn into him. And again, now he fully absorbed in his relationship with Rama Devi. So, in that sense then, the jivas, the conditioned souls, are the cause of the creation. Because he wouldn't bother glancing, there'd be no need to glance if there weren't any conditioned souls to be glanced into the whole thing. So therefore, in that sense also, the conditioned souls, they're the hetu. Ultimately, you could say. Yeah, so it's like that. Prabhupada, one time, Prabhupada was saying, talking about how if this Krishna consciousness movement spreads, everyone can go back to Godhead. All of humanity, back home, back to Godhead. One devotee said, but Prabhupada, if everyone goes back to Godhead, what'll happen to the human race? Prabhupada said, yes, this is our goal. No more human race. Then Prabhupada said, don't worry. There'll always be some fools. You know, so you don't need to worry. Conditioned souls won't be lonely in the material world. Yeah. So therefore, the jiva is the hetu in this sense. And it corresponds with uti also. And, you know, sarga and visarga arguably in sort of indirectly. So, 63.3. Well, now, Jiva Goswami begins the description of the Ashraya, or Suta Goswami's Ashraya, which he calls Apashraya. So there are three verses, actually, 12.7, 19, 20, and 21. So in 63.3, he quotes 12.7, 19 and discusses it. And it's sort of the main one to my mind. The Supreme Absolute Truth is present throughout all the states of awareness, waking consciousness, sleep, and deep sleep. Throughout all the phenomena manifested by the external energy, and within the functions of all living entities, and he also exists separate from all these. Thus situated in his own transcendence, he is the ultimate and unique shelter. Apashraya indicates, well, in this context, ultimate. That ultimate shelter. You know, we know that there may, under certain circumstances, be other things which can be considered shelters, but the apashraya means, it's sort of like swashraya shraya, if you remember that. The same idea. That ultimate final shelter, even of things which can be considered shelters. So, Jiva Goswami says, it cannot be said that the Jiva is the Ashraya even in his pure state. That would go against what Srila Vyasadeva experienced in trance. Rather, the correct understanding is as follows. Before we read that, it's certainly a fact that the Jiva, you know, the Jiva just got described in 63.2 in the previous Bhagavatam verse, and he's just all confused and entangled in Maya. So, you know, how could he be the Apashraya? He couldn't be the Apashraya. It's not possible. He's confused. He's under the control of Maya and just going from body to body and life to life and going to hell. And, you know, just going through all these horrific things due to his own foolishness. So how could he be the Apashraya? He certainly couldn't be the Apashraya. Well, what about the pure Jiva? What about the pure Jiva? Well, now, Jiva Goswami is going to give like an explanation, really, that the correct understanding in general is as follows. The Supreme Brahman is alone in his original identity. He is always aloof from the states of consciousness, known as waking awareness and so on, and also from the manifestations of matter, beginning with the Mahatattva. All these are products of the external energy, that is to say, creations of his Maya potency. While remaining aloof from all these manifestations, he simultaneously associates with them in his feature as the Supersoul, the Supreme Witness. Therefore, he is the basis for the Jiva's activities in both his pure and his conditioned state. In his pure state as well. But in this context, the word apashraya indicates that even while he is the foundation for the Jiva's activities, he still remains transcendental to everything. The prefix apa, now this is like, you know, sort of a slightly different understanding to apashraya or the apa part. The prefix apa refers to abandonment, which here amounts to the idea of transcending. So it's really only the Supreme Brahman, the Supersoul, the Supreme Lord, ultimately Krishna. It's really only Krishna who could truly be said to have just totally abandoned the material nature. And there's no question, there's no hope, possibility, likelihood. It doesn't exist in any way that he might, you know, fall under it. Because the jiva soul, even in his pure state, you know, it's sort of like, you never know. Because he's marginal potency, you know, it's not going to be impossible if he decides at some point, look, I want to go back to Finland or, you know, wherever. Where are you from? I want to go back to the West Indies and get together with the Rasta people. Or I want to go back to France or Russia or England or wherever it is. I want to go back there and give it another go. It is not impossible that the living entity, you know, might just have some whim like that. Or say, if he decided, then he can go. It's not that if you decide that you really want to go, that you won't be allowed to go. You know, when I joined, and actually I've never found a reference for it, but a number of devotees, you know, back in those days, we didn't have email, but, well, we had the ISKCON grapevine, it was already developing quite nicely. But there was some, you know, communication going on, definitely. And Prabhupada was there, so, you know, every few days, every now and then, a message would come. Prabhupada said, you know, like Prabhupada was traveling around always lecturing. So it was always coming. Prabhupada's doing this, now Prabhupada's here, now Prabhupada's going there. You know, Prabhupada's giving class on Ajamil. Prabhupada's doing this. Prabhupada said this the other day. So I remember the buzz, one of the buzzes when I joined, was that Prabhupada had just said that when the living entity has made up his mind to fall down into the material world from Goloka or up there somewhere, the last thing that happens is that Krishna comes and personally tries to convince him not to. But sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes he's just, you know, the jiva's just got his mind made up too much. But that's what the word was, the buzz, that Prabhupada just said this, that as a last ditch effort, as the jiva's just about to dive out the window into the material world, Krishna comes along and says, wait a minute, and has a final attempt. But it didn't work on us, did it? We are hard nuts to crack. Yeah. So, the pure jiva then is marginal energy. Krishna Atatasta Shakti Bade Abade Prakash. In one sense, that is the cause or the sort of the, what would you say, the potential for the loving relationship, that there is a real alternative. If you really want it, there is an alternative. It's really not that you have to. Yeah, there is an alternative. You are. The marginal situation is really there. So when you choose Krishna, then it is really, it's a loving relationship that develops. Because it is a real choice made with a real alternative. So that adds, in a sense, the magic to the relationship. You know, if you just had to, like a machine part, you just had to function in a certain way, wouldn't be so exciting. But at the same time, you know, there's the risk factor. So even the pure jiva is dependent on Krishna. It's always dependent. Always dependent on the super soul. Always dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And couldn't really, the sense of abandonment, just utter abandonment, just like infinitely rejecting the material nature, that is really there in the apashraya. That is really there in the absolute truth. But it's not really there, not to the same degree, even with the pure jivas. What to speak of the conditioned jivas? Yeah. And you know, if you want to say that, you know, maybe this verse is referring not just to all the jivas, but just to the pure jivas, then, you know, it's some of these things are just not really there. That the pure jiva is always going through all these things and giving the shelter, being the shelter. He may be independent as a pure living entity, but giving shelter to the material world, he's not giving shelter to it. You know, particularly we see when he goes a little off track, he falls down into the material world. So how could we say he's really the shelter? So it is the super soul. He really is just the witness. He's never anything more. He could never be, or other than, say. He could never really be an actual participant. But even the pure jiva has the potential for becoming an actual participant in material existence. So, 63.4. Such knowledge of the pure jiva, who is here designated the cause of material existence, leads to realization of the apashraya, or transcendental fountainhead of existence. As Sutta Goswami states in two verses, the next two verses, although a material object may assume various forms and names, its essential ingredient is always present as the basis of its existence. Similarly, both conjointly and separately, the jiva is always present with the created material body throughout its phases of existence, beginning with conception and ending with death. Well, he's going to actually go on in the next verse, next text, to explain this further. Then the next verse, either on the strength of one's own power of discrimination, or because of one's regulated spiritual practice, one's mind may stop functioning on the material platform of waking consciousness, sleep, and deep sleep. Then the jiva understands the Supreme Soul and withdraws from material endeavor. Well, let's just go on to 63.5 because he discusses it more there. We can consider the substances, earth, water, and so on, to be either associated with their products, having names and forms such as pots, or separate from them. After all, we can identify these substances even apart from their products. Now, you have a clay pot, and you have clay. You don't need to have the clay pot to understand clay. But the clay pot is an entity, a specific entity And you don't, if you've got a clay pot, you can't just say that, well, you know, it's just clay. It's now a clay pot. So he's making this distinction between the product and the original substance. In the same way, although by the force of ignorance, the originally pure spirit soul becomes involved with the nine stages of life from conception to death, he can nonetheless become indifferent by understanding that he is, in fact, distinct from all this by virtue of his being a pure soul. Thus becoming aloof, he is then qualified to inquire about the Ashraya. That is the purport of the verse beginning Vira Mata, the first verse. Wait a minute. The second verse. Oh, okay. Second verse. Well, it's the purport of both verses, actually. Yeah. So, conditioned soul may look like, you know, it may seem he is this body, but he's not this body. He's the basis, and he's distinct. Distinct from all these things. So if, well, let's just carry on actually and read the rest. The vritti triyam, three functional states, which is referred to in that second verse, verse 21. The vritti triyam, three functional states, are the states of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. Atmanam, self, here means the supersoul. Swayam, by oneself, means by carefully studying the illusory nature of the world, as the sage Vamadev did. Yogena, by yoga, indicates that one may conduct the study by means of the kind of meditation Srimati Devahuti and others practiced. Ihaya nivartate, he becomes free from all actions, means that he refrains from all activities other than the practice of God realization. Then he says, this is our explanation of Sambandha, the connection between Srimad Bhagavatam and the subject it discusses. That's another thing. I'll explain briefly about that shortly. But here, the idea is that the jiva can understand himself to be separate and understand himself to be under the shelter of the Ashraya. It's possible. By here, you know, there are different means, but here he's suggesting two. Now, don't be disappointed, because this is the end, really. This is as far as he goes. So don't be disappointed that he doesn't just jump up and say, surrender to Krishna, devotional service is the only way, or something like that. You know, it is a little kind of broader than that, isn't it? You know, through gyan, some cultivation of knowledge, something like that. You know, it means a theistic type of philosophical process like the sage Vamadev followed. Not really an impersonal process. It's a theistic, a personal type of philosophical process that this Vamadev and others followed. Or like Devahuti. Of course we can relate to Devahuti more, because this is referring to the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam and Lord Kapila instructing Devahuti on this meditation, meditating on the form of the Lord. You know, it's a very beautiful description. And we referred to it. Actually, we read a few verses in the first couple of days, if you recall that. That was considered what? A direct description. That was a direct description, because it's actually describing the Lord himself. Hmm? that was, before we got into the 10 topics, it was where he was saying that the first nine, are actually describing the 10th, either through prayers, or directly, or indirectly. So the directly meant in terms of he himself as an individual, not just as one participant in some pastime, like how he delivered Parikshit. Then it's kind of like he is one participant, of course, very important participant, but it's a little different from an actual description of he himself. So Devahuti then, this is devotional service, but he doesn't even really say exactly, you know, devotional service like Devahuti. He says this type of meditation that Devahuti did under the instruction of Kapila. But it all, you know, just be satisfied enough. He's just in these general and introductory terms presenting the basic idea. As he goes through Bhagavat Sandarbha and Paramatma Sandarbha and then Krishna Sandarbha, he really brings everything to the point, which is Krishna, devotional service like that. Yeah. But here at this point, Jiva Goswami concludes the discussion, actually. He concludes the discussion that through these methods, one can realize the Apashraya, the Supreme Absolute Truth. One can realize Krishna. Okay. Then this little thing here, this is our explanation of Sambandha, the connection between Srimad Bhagavatam and the subject it discusses. So, you know, normally we take this term Sambandha to mean the relationship of everything with Krishna particularly. Or even in a broader sense, Sambandha means just the relationship of everything with everything else. Of anything with everything else. It can be very broad like that. But here, at the beginning of Tattva Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami talked of Sambandha in terms of being the relationship, Sambandha means relationship, between Srimad Bhagavatam and the subject it discusses. Now what does that mean? It basically means, how does Srimad Bhagavatam relate with its subject? How does it describe its subject? So what is the subject? Krishna. The Absolute Truth. The Supreme Brahman. Ultimately Krishna. Krishna is the subject. So how does Srimad Bhagavatam describe its subject, describe Krishna? Like this. He's the Ashraya. He's the Apashraya. You know, other books may describe Krishna as being a political character. So the Sambandha is like that. The relationship is like that. That it relates with him as a political character. Some books may describe him as, you know, someone who runs around with women. So that's another type of relationship. But here, Srimad Bhagavatam, the way it relates with Krishna, with its subject, is like this. He is the Ashraya. He is the Apashraya. He is Swa Shraya Shraya. That's how the Bhagavatam describes Krishna, its subject. Right, so then 63.6 is the final conclusion, just some concluding words. Thus ends the Tattva Sandarbha, the first book of the Bhagavat Sandarbha, because the Bhagavat Sandarbha also can refer to all six. as well as one of the six is called the Bhagavat Sandarbha. But sometimes all six are called the Bhagavat Sandarbha. Which was written according to the instructions of Srila Rupa Goswami and Srila Sanatan Goswami, the revered leaders of the Universal Royal Assembly of Vaishnavas. They're unalloyed servants of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the purifier of the jivas in Kali Yuga, who descended to distribute the benediction of his own devotional service. So thus ends the Tattva Sandarbha. Thus ends our course, our seminar on the Tattva Sandarbha also. Any comments or questions?
Well, yeah, sure, they are.
They're not apashraya or swashrayashraya, but they are on behalf of Krishna, yeah. They are ashrayas, of course. You know, he didn't mention it, obviously, but... Yeah. Well, there are many things which are sources of shelter in certain respects, and the spiritual masters are sources of shelter in terms of their being under the shelter of Krishna. But he is the apashraya. He's never, you know, there's never any question of him ever being anything else, or having been, or that he might possibly ever be, or could, you know, like that. He's just permanently, so therefore he is that ultimate one, under all circumstances. Is it true? Well, I just described, you know, the circumstances. I said I haven't read it. But I do recall when I joined, it was one of the latest things. Did you hear? Prabhupada said that. So, you know, if it's valid, if it's a fact that Prabhupada said it, then I'm sure it is true. But I qualified it by saying I never saw it written, but yeah, we heard that. Yeah. He hasn't said it here, exactly. But it's not really part of our seminar. I think it's part of another seminar. So it's okay. Yeah. But he's never really in deep sleep. It's not the same. It's not the same. It's a mystical trance of ecstatic absorption in his relationship with his consort. You know, before anyone goes, we want to give you the test, which, you know, I leave it up to you whether you do it or not. I leave it up to you whether, put it this way, you can use the book to refer to if you want. Do the test, give it to the office, okay? By Tuesday afternoon. Is that okay? Today's Sunday. Is that all right? Can you pass these around? Whoever wants can take one. If you, you know, if you prefer not to do it, it's okay also. But I think, you know, if you do it, it does help focus a little and just absorb things more. Any other comment or question? You know, I mean, that's like a whole sort of discussion, really. But the thing is, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Upadrastana Mantacha, Bharata Bhokta Maheshvara, Paramatmeti Chapyukto, Dehismin Purushamparam, that within this body there's another person. He's the Lord. He's the Super Soul. And he exists as overseer and permitter. You know, if he wants, he can sort of do anything, actually, if he wants. But essentially, he's there as overseer and permitter. Yeah. And even, you know, when it comes to like direct hands-on control, it's more done by the demigods. Yamaraj, judges, and transport sees they get placed in their next position and they get what they deserve. Yamaraj does it. And others do, you know, all the various other detailed workings. So, but in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says he's overseer and permitter. So, upadrasta. It's just going on under his eyes. Mayad yakshena. Just going on under his eyes, you know. He's not having to manipulate things. The demigods do that. But if he wants, he can do anything. He can turn it upside down. Even, you know, another thing. Prabhupada was asked once that the jivas, they're said to be eternal. But if Krishna wanted to, could he destroy a jiva? And Prabhupada said, yes, he could. But he doesn't. He won't do that. Okay, devotees. Rama. She's an expansion of Radharani. With every expansion of Krishna, there is a like concomitant, suitable expansion of Radharani. Sita Ram, Lakshmi Narayan, Radha Krishna, you know, Revati Balaram, and so on and so on. Rama Mahavishnu. So she is a suitable expansion, suitable for Mahavishnu. Expansion of Radharani. Okay, so that's the end of our course. And, you know, do the test as you like. Hand it in to the office by any time on Tuesday, and we'll mark it, you know, over the following couple of days. And otherwise, thanks very much for taking part, and please forgive us for the numerous shortcomings. And Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.